Inventory, what does that mean? Personal inventory. Moral inventory. Well, all of these concepts have to do with recovery. Many of you who are viewing this are recovering from alcoholism, chemical dependency, all kinds of other things. Alcoholics Anonymous has only been with us shortly over 50 years. And in those 50 years, in its wisdom, it has guided the membership to do certain things that are suggested by the early members, which they found not only relieved them of the bondage of alcohol, if you want it, but gave them a new freedom in their life. And the turning point in that program, the point that separates the men from the boys, the women from the young ladies, seems to be two of the 12 steps, step 4 and step 5. With this time together, we want to explore step 4 and 5. For those of you who don't understand steps or find that a new idea, Alcoholics Anonymous and many of the wonderful programs that have borrowed the methods that they use, Al-Anon for families, Gamblers Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Emotions Anonymous, on and on and on. All of those programs are outlined in 12 statements that describe how a person grows and develops and lives through that program. Let me set the stage in this way by saying that step 4 reads this way. We took a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. So that involves some reflection, involves some paperwork. Step 5, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. So we take the material from step 4 and we do something about it. Just a little background about myself so that you know how and why I'm so interested in this. For 10 years I ran an alcohol and drug abuse program for the Roman Catholic Diocese of Phoenix. And this pamphlet describes many of the things that that program was about. Something that's not mentioned here became a very important part of that program. I'll speak to that in just a moment. Another thing that flowed from that program was this document, which is a manual or the policy of the diocese, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Phoenix, on alcoholism and chemical dependency. And what it really does is it goes on record saying that we recognize alcoholism as a disease, not as a moral problem, and that people who have that problem, priests in particular, because we started with the priests, and you know some priests drink, and you know some of the priests who drink become alcoholics. And I found myself working with this group. So we wanted to go on record first as helping that group. And I'm here to report that a great deal of help has come to them. But something that I was unaware of in the sense of being involved in that in my life was this work with fourth and fifth steps, because so many people came to me when I started that program. The job description was beautiful. The bishop said, you be anywhere, you do anything that helps alcoholism, recovery from it, and about every 6 months, tell me where you've been and what you've done. And one of the places where I went that I didn't think I was going to go was hearing a lot of fifth steps. I've heard hundreds, I'm sure more than 1,000. And I want to share with you, as a professional in the field of alcoholism, as a clergyman who has received the confidence and the trust of many people who have chosen to take their fifth step with me, some of the experience that was mine, some of the great privilege that I have had in my life of being in your life in that most special, private, wonderful way. Let's talk about step 4 for a while. Those of you that aren't familiar with step 1, 2, and 3, I'll fill that in just a moment. Step 4 says we took a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now, how do we do that? Well, you can get some pamphlets, some booklets that tell you about inventory. I've collected over 35 different pamphlets or papers that help a person take their inventory. Hazleton, a large treatment center in Minnesota, has put out several versions of the fourth step inventory as they have used it, as they have found it helpful to people. So that's evolved and that's changed. Al-Anon, which is a recovery program for family members, Al-Anon family groups, publishes a wonderful little pamphlet called A Blueprint for Progress. But what I'd like to present with you in the time that I have right now is the classical way that we find in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that is suggested for those of you who qualify for these programs to take an inventory, and then I'll give you some reflections on a clergyman who has been the beneficiary or heard a lot of that. So let's just begin. Step four says we took a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. So here's step four. Let's not overlook any of the little words, searching. What does that mean? That means to be thorough. If you're going to do this, have at it. Don't do it half-heartedly or a little bit at a time. If you're going to do an inventory, be complete. Give yourself to the process totally. There are closed and open AA meetings. I've had the privilege of attending many open AA meetings. Open AA meetings are for anyone who's interested in attending. Closed are just for those of you who are recovering alcoholics. In one of those open AA meetings, I observed something that went like this. Apparently, there'd been a member of that group for a period of years, or a period of months, rather, who went out and drank again. And the group had heard that he was drinking, and he kind of disappeared from the face of the earth for a couple of years. And then he came back. And when he came back, he was mad. And I happened to be there the night he came back. He said, "Boy, I'm upset with you guys. I did everything you told me, and I got drunk anyway." Well, that got their attention. They really started to listen. He said, "You know, you told me that when I was really upset, and I felt that I had this terrible problem, but yet I didn't want to talk to anybody, and I felt different, that was called a dry drunk. And I don't know what a dry drunk was, but I felt that way. And I remembered your advice. You said to call someone. So I had a member's name, and I called them, and there wasn't any answer. So I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous in the phone book, and I called them. And the line was busy. So I got drunk." Now let me finish that story in a moment. We're at the Franciscan Renewal Center in Paradise Valley. Just a couple of miles in this direction is Camelback Mountain, which is a beautiful, beautiful mountain. Let's pretend, let's fantasize. Let's suppose that on top of Camelback Mountain there is the last case of whiskey in the whole world. There's no alcohol anywhere in the world except it exists in that case on top of that mountain. Now, if you think about that for a moment, that makes that real valuable. In fact, it's probably so valuable that they have barbed wire around it, landmines, marines, guard dogs. And what that means is if any of you would like to take a drink of alcohol, somehow you have to get into that case of whiskey that's on top of Camelback Mountain. Now, we have a large number of people here today, some of whom are alcoholics, recovering alcoholics. Let's, God forbid this doesn't happen, but let's say this group that's with us today who are recovering alcoholics, and again, you can't tell the alcoholics from the non-alcoholics in this group. Let's suppose they decided to drink. And in order to drink, they had to get that alcohol off Camelback Mountain. Well, this is mid-afternoon right now. I'm sure that sometime before the sun goes down tonight, one of the people in this group is going to be in that case of whiskey. That's a small problem for a thirsty alcoholic to solve. In fact, I'm sure there's someone who'd have it delivered. I don't know how he'd pull that off. But that's a small problem for someone who is an alcoholic and wants a drink. That kind of separates the alcoholics from the non-alcoholics anyway. The non-alcoholics say, "How do they do that?" I don't know how they do it, but we'd talk our way into or around somebody. I'm sure that would occur. I told you a story about a man who went out and got drunk. and we fantasized about some whiskey on top of a mountain. You're probably wondering what I'm going to say next. What I'm going to say next is this. Those are the same stories. Because they have to do with energy and dedication on the one hand and lack of it in the other. You see, that friend of mine who had a drinking problem and went out and drank again thought he went to great heroic lengths to stay sober. Actually, all he did was attempt to make 2 phone calls. But that was so new and it felt so uncomfortable to him, and it was something he'd not done before, that he was exhausted after putting the dimes in the phone and making that effort. And he really thought he went to great heroic lengths. But that was nothing compared to the dedication and the skill and the enthusiasm and the energy that went into getting into that case of alcohol that was on top of the mountain. You see all the energy and the talent that went into the one thing and the lack of it in the other? Okay, but in the mind of that first man, he thought he went to great lengths too. But he didn't. Searching. A searching and fearless moral inventory. If you're going to do this inventory, be as thorough, as complete, as searching as you can. Use all the cunning and skillfulness and giftedness and talent that you have, and use it in a positive way to take this moral inventory. Okay, so searching, that's the first word. Take a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. How do you take this moral inventory? Well, be searching, we've covered that. Now how about the fearless part? Well, if you think of what an inventory is, it's taking a look at your life and realizing the major mistakes that you've made. Nobody's going to be too thrilled about that. Anybody that's lived much life at all is going to be afraid to do that. So how do you do a fearless one? Well, I looked at the Alcoholics Anonymous literature, and in their book, Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a good clue. It says, whenever you're afraid, ask immediately that the fear be removed. Now, don't take my word for it. Try that. Probably everyone that's listening to me right now is afraid of something. Afraid of embarrassment, afraid of speaking up, afraid of participating, afraid of admitting that you have a drinking problem, afraid of asking for help, afraid of being misunderstood. Those are all common fears that many of us have. Ask immediately that the fear be removed. Who do you ask? You ask that higher power, God, as you understand him, that you came to know in a previous step in this program of recovery. And just try that, and you'll find out that one of 2 wonderful things will happen. The one is, this is the least likely, but it happens enough so that it's real. And that is that the fear will be removed. The other wonderful thing that always happens if that doesn't occur is that the paralysis is removed, even if the fear isn't. You can move on, you can do the next thing, you get into motion about it. Now, old-timers, people in the field of alcoholism, people involved in recovery, and those are the real professionals. The recovering alcoholics are the real pros. A lot of people who think they're professional are kind of amateurs, so that's a nice little twist. A lot of the old-timers, a lot of the pros say that self-knowledge won't keep a person sober. I believe that. So what we're involved in here in step 4 really is self-knowledge. But it's self-knowledge in the context of something. Let me show you what I mean. Prior to step 4, you take 3 other steps, 1, 2, and 3. Step 1 says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We establish a problem. Step 2 says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step 1 is bad news. Appropriate feelings when you find out that step 1 applies to you is depression, anger, fear, fright, confusion, just chronic, massive upsetness. And that's appropriate. But step 2 is good news. You find out, hey, there is an answer. And it's working in the lives of a lot of people. And as a newcomer starts becoming involved in recovery and going to meetings, he'll see that or she'll see that. And that's wonderful because they know it's working in the lives of other people. If they stay faithful to that program, they'll find out eventually that it's working in their life too. And that's really the blessing. Step three, after you discover this higher power in step two, just so you have it, is we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Wonderful good news. But it's good news only for the person who knows the bad news. You know, you need to be in trouble before you feel relief having some hope of getting out of it. You see, for centuries, people have been designing recovery programs for alcoholics, long before they had the word alcoholic, people who had chronic drinking problems. And most of those programs began with a statement something like this: there is an all-loving God that can help you. And most alcoholics said, forget it. And they never went on from there. But this program doesn't start with God, it starts with the problem. And it establishes what the suffering alcoholic knows best: pain. And that's good news and bad news. There isn't a recovering alcoholic that I know of or have ever met that got to recovery any other way than through pain. They all get there the same way. Haven't met anybody yet who just bounded into an AA meeting and said, guess what, I'm an alcoholic. My life's unmanageable and I thought I'd join this wonderful group. Doesn't work that way. They kind of mope and drag through the door. If they say they're an alcoholic, they can hardly get the words out and they won't make eye contact with anybody. And if they feel that down and depressed, they're right on schedule. And one time I was talking this way to a large group of alcoholics in a treatment center, and I made the point, I said, if you've been drinking recently, which a third of them had, they came in toxic to the treatment center, and you're really depressed and really upset, you're doing just great, you're right on schedule. So I watched a third of these people who were really depressed kind of all brighten up, and hey, I'm doing something right, you know? And then they realized they were supposed to be depressed and they got back into that thing again. It was hilarious to watch that take place. But the real basis of this whole recovery program is admitting how can you fix a problem until you know you have one? And this is the kind of a problem no one is ever going to admit that they have without enormous pressure. So much pressure that it takes pain to do that. So step one is bad news, step two is good news. There is an answer. Then step three says we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of a higher power. Or as most people would phrase that, God as we understand him. But they don't have to call that higher power God either. There's a lot of freedom in that style of recovery. Father Joseph Martin made a wonderful film called Chalk Talk. I hope you all get to see that. It's timeless. There's great power in that film. And he paraphrases those first three steps this way: I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. Now that's the kind of strength that you build before you attempt step four. So we will assume that the person has collected that kind of energy and that kind of strength and experience, and now they're ready to do this searching and fearless moral inventory. Searching means to be thorough, to be complete. And I love the way they wrote these steps for alcoholics because they challenge any grandiosity the person has. Be searching, be fearless. You know, in one part of their literature, they talk about if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, you know, the poor guy at that stage can hardly get out of bed, and they're asking him to go to any length. There's wonderful ways in which Alcoholics Anonymous seems to work backwards from conventional wisdom, but it works. You know, it really works, and nothing works like success. So as a professional in the alcoholism field, I can't recommend Alcoholics Anonymous enough. Can't recommend Al-Anon enough. But a word of caution: that doesn't mean reading the book, reading the literature. It means going to meetings. It means going to a lot of meetings, maybe a meeting a day for a month at least, and talking to people before and after and asking questions. Because it takes that long to begin to catch on to what's going on. And even for the person that doesn't catch on intellectually, they catch on emotionally, because they see progress and they see growth and they see health and they see something they want in other people that are involved in that kind of a process. So it's an exciting thing. And as a clergyman, it's a really exciting thing, because our success rate with these problems runs around 2 or 3%. So it's nice to watch something work where we have failed from our viewpoint. Searching and fearless, moral inventory. How do you take this moral inventory? Well, the literature suggests that you make three lists. I'll just draw three squares up here. And we'll deal with this first square at this time, and it's resentments. So this is a resentment list. And what you're asked to do here is to list by name the people, places, and things that you're resentful at. Now, there are many different interpretations of how to do this. I'm just giving you the benefit of my understanding at the present, so that may change in the future. One of the controversial points, one of the points that people argue about is this. Do you just inventory your life when you were drinking? Is that what you're trying to solve, or is it an inventory of your whole life? My personal opinion is it's an inventory of your whole life. And the reason for that is there's only one of you. And we want to get all of the one of you that there is there as comfortable as we can. So the more you know about yourself, the more material you have to work with. To do it the other way is to buy into the denial and the minimizing, and it really isn't that bad yet kind of a thing. It contradicts the concept of being searching or thorough. So what's a resentment? A lot of people have trouble with that because they get it all mixed up with anger, and they're two different things. Anger is healthy, anger is wonderful. If you drive the freeways in this country, I hope you get angry. It is a normal, healthy response. If you see a situation like this, which I did not long ago, I was in a supermarket and I saw a parent really abusing a small child, just yanking it around, you know, with one hand, the kid's swinging. All in the name of discipline. And I really wanted to go up and tell that parent what I thought, but it just seemed out of place. But I sure got angry and I sure got sad. And I hope you get angry and sad listening to that. Because kids don't get over a lot of those things. Anger is wonderful. It gets us in touch with our sense of values and rightness and wrongness. However, the human being, men and women, are not meant to stay angry. Physically, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, to stay angry is to do violence to ourselves, regardless of what the situation is. And the chronic anger, the thing, the person, place, or thing that we stay angry about is what we call a resentment. I'm going to talk like a priest here for a minute. Recenturi, the Latin words mean to resensitize, or another version of that would be to rebirth or to bring back to life something that's already been dead. So we were angry at one time and we had a good situation, or a reason for being angry. Let's see. We have a nice fellow in the front row here who's paying attention. What's your first name?
Joe.
Joe. Let's suppose while I'm talking up here, I'm trying real hard to keep everybody's attention and to make this interesting. And Joe is in the front row, disinterested and kind of nodding out and falling asleep. And that really upsets me, because I'm trying hard and there's old Joe nodding out right in front of everybody. So I decide to get even with him. And I talk in a nice soft voice and I start sneaking up on Joe. And I get all the way over to Joe and I hit him just as hard as I can, knock him over the chair, under the chair, behind him. Suppose I did that, Joe, how would you feel?
I'd feel angry.
Good, I hope you'd feel angry. We all hope you would feel angry. If someone hits you for no apparent reason, I hope you get angry. That's appropriate. That's healthy angry. I know a lot of people, particularly a lot of alcoholics, that you can come up to like that, hit in the mouth, knock them over a couple of rows of chairs, and say, how do you feel? And they'd say something like this. It's all right. It's okay. Must be part of the talk. crazy. And what that kind of an attitude does is really reflect back at an intuitive understanding that a lot of chemically dependent, a lot of alcoholic people have, that anger got them in a lot of trouble. So somehow they make a decision that they're never going to get angry, because they used to get angry and it got out of hand. It's wonderful to be appropriately angry and to get over with it and to get on with life. Now, suppose that happened. We'll say that, we'll pretend that Joe's in recovery, and I really did something that was unjust, and he should probably talk to somebody about this. Did you hear what Gavin did to me? Hit me for no apparent reason. Well, he needs to work that out and confront me about it. If he's still talking about it a month from now, did you hear what Gavin did to me? Now he's got a problem he didn't have before, huh? Pretty soon he's got poor Joe bumper stickers, and we're all going, isn't that too bad? At this point, all we're doing is feeding his resentment. We're feeding his sickness, because that's what a resentment is. Chronic anger is self-induced sickness. Now, a lot of people don't know how to get rid of resentments. First of all, you got to recognize them. Find out you have them. A lot of people in early recovery say, gee, I'd do an inventory, but I've never had a resentment. You know, my God, where have they been? They don't really understand what it is yet. So, resentments. And you put on that list the people, places, and things that you're resentful at or ever were resentful at. A couple of names that belong on that list that you might not think of would be your own. A lot of us have enormous resentments against ourselves. Not long ago, I double booked myself. I was supposed to be in San Diego and in Phoenix at the same time, the same date. I spent a whole day trying to find someone I could blame that on. Couldn't find anybody except me. So I finally apologized to the one person and straightened it out, but I was still angry at me, and I was still angry at me a week later. That's stupid. That's a mistake. Because physically, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, we're not meant to be angry on a consistent basis. It's like pouring battery acid. People will tell you physiologically that's what it's like. We just do harm to ourselves. And that brings up another thing. There's a so-called justified resentment. For example, Joe and myself here, I did something wrong. I hit him for no apparent reason. So Joe might take the line of reasoning that it's okay for me to have a resentment because I was right and he was wrong. Well, let me rephrase that. How does this sound? It's okay for me to beat up on myself because he did something that was wrong. Now that sounds bizarre. But you need to process it and take it apart enough so you see what it is before you know it's bizarre. Huh? Joe needs to be angry, but he needs to get over his anger. People, places, and things. There's a man that I know that if you mention a certain town, the town happens to be Buckeye, Arizona, he gets all upset, he gets red in the face and can't talk. Now, I don't know what happened at Buckeye, but if this guy did an inventory, I'm sure Buckeye would go on that inventory, you know, because it just triggers something with him. And we all have places like that. And a lot of them have to do with institutions. I should get a real emotional response if I just do some word association games and play with you and say things like church, police, bill collectors, IRS. That's stirring up a lot of things, jiggling a lot of things loose. So people, places, and things. Institutions like marriage, the court system, divorce. People, places, and things. And another thing that I need to point out here, you don't really want to be too logical about this. You want to be thorough. But it's real easy to do an inventory and to put something down and say, well, that doesn't make sense. That's silly. But if you were resentful for any length of time over it, it still goes down, whether it was silly or not. Huh? I had occasion to know an individual who went on and on and on about this big resentment that he had against a business partner who really, literally got control of the company, stole the company out from under his partner's feet, and it was a very specialized industry, then went around and told all his colleagues all kinds of lies about the guy and discredited him professionally so that no one would hire him. A lot of good reasons for being angry, but not a good reason for being resentful. He went on and on and on talking about this resentment. And when he got done, I just happened to have presence of mind to say, does this guy still live in the same town with you? I'm glad I asked the question. He says, no, he's been dead for 20 years. And no sooner did the man say he's been dead for 20 years than he saw how dumb it was to stay angry over that. But I hope in hearing that story you realize how human it is to stay angry about that. Now, why would we want to take an inventory? We want to take an inventory to learn as much about what's really going on in our life, particularly in those areas that we don't want to look at, so that we can be free of the bondage that we suffer because of that. Elvis Presley had a wonderful song called Taking Care of Business. That's what an inventory is. That's what a good fourth step is. Taking care of the unfinished business in our life that has had power over us because we didn't want to think about it or we didn't want to deal with it. So, resentments, people, places, and things. Oh, another word that goes on most people's inventory list is God. Most people don't like to put that down. There are a lot of us, you see, you don't have to be involved in a 12-step program to take an inventory, and I was doing one day, and I wrote down God, and then I erased it. So that's not nice. Most of what goes on in inventory isn't nice anyway. I'm mad at God a lot. I think he's slow. I just wish he'd hurry up. I see somebody hurting, and I wish he'd fix it. Doesn't sound very nice out loud, but I believe that, and I operate that way within my personal life. So whatever person, place, or thing you're resentful at or ever have been resentful about goes on that list, goes on that paper. Those are the resentments. And opposite the people, places, and things on that list, you go back and you kind of briefly describe what it is. I'm resentful at Gavin because he stood me up. He made an appointment with me and didn't show up. Then in the third column you put in how it affects you. It affects my sanity, my pride, my self-esteem, my sex relations, whatever it happens to be. You can put any word you want in there. So you kind of have three columns for this. Person, place, and thing here. A brief little description. This isn't a whole lot of analysis about what happened. I'm mad at so-and-so because he cut me off in traffic. I'm mad at this person because he said he'd pay me so much for this job and he only paid me half. And that affects my pride or whatever it is. That's how you do that. Now let's move on to the second large list, which is fears. And this one is fun because it goes so fast. You list the things that you're afraid of. And what most people are afraid of are things like this, of being misunderstood, of being left out, of not being part of being laughed at, afraid of sharing what's really going on inside. Now here's a place where I can share some of my experience with you. I've heard hundreds of fifth steps. You know, I've never once heard anybody say, I am afraid of nuclear attack. And if you've got a brain in your head, we all ought to be scared to death of that. But that doesn't have immediacy. It's not real close to us on an emotional level. I've heard a lot of women say, I'm afraid of mice or bugs or creepy crawly things. I've heard a lot of men say that too, who were honest enough to do a thorough inventory. A lot of men don't get along very well with mice and bugs either. If you're afraid of it, it goes on that inventory. You may be, I had a friend who one night found himself reading a magazine by a flashlight at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's a bizarre thought anyway. But when he explained it, it made sense. He said there was a power failure as he was going to go to sleep, and he kept tossing and turning because he was used to going to sleep with a light on and the radio playing. And because it was dark, he didn't know how to go to sleep. And he wanted to get tired enough to fall asleep, so he's reading this book with a flashlight, when he suddenly realized walking around the house at 4 in the morning with a flashlight reading a novel is deviant behavior. Kind of strange. And then what became painfully aware to him was the fact that he was afraid of the dark. Here he is, a middle-aged man, didn't know he was afraid of the dark, but he found it out. So that goes on your fear list. I'm afraid of the dark, whatever it happens to be. And then opposite those fears, and again, don't try to rate them or prioritize them. Just put them down, whatever you're afraid of. Ask yourself why you might have them and what you could do about that. Now that sounds a little strange to some people that are not familiar with program, but it's actually in the AA literature to do it that way. So I like to pass that along. What I want to present is the classical way of doing this, because if a person does that, then they can do some variations a little later on. I'll get into some favorite variations that I have. So, resentments, fear, and the third list. First list is resentment, second one is fear, third list is sex. So what you do is you list by name the people that you've been intimate with. And some people have a big long list, some people have a little short list. And let me just remind you that it's not a contest. You know, I got more names than you got. Or if you're super moral, self-righteous type, I've only got one name or something. It has nothing to do with what you're about here. Whatever's on that list is what applies to your life. And opposite those names, you ask yourself these questions. In this relationship with this individual, where was I selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? If you want to remember these words, you can find them in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't ask where was she selfish or where was he selfish. Where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I inconsiderate? And I'd like to point out that even in healthy relationships, there's an enormous amount of dishonesty, particularly if you've fallen in love. Falling in love is a genetic, chemical kind of thing, where you're attracted strongly to someone. And it's effortless. All you do is see them. You know, oh, there she is. There he is. When God created her, he was having one of his better days. When God created him, he was showing off. Or if you're a spiritual person, you say, oh, God's will. You know the kind of thing I'm talking about? Now, in those situations, there's a lot of dishonesty because you're so infatuated and you're so taken up with that other person that when they suggest things that you think they might like, all of a sudden you like them. Guess what television's on? Program is on tonight, my favorite television program. Would you like to watch it? Maybe you hate the program. And you say, would I like to watch it? Of course I would. What that person hears is, he likes the program. What's going on inside of your head is, I'd like to watch even a dumb program with you. Right? But you've created a false impression. You've created the impression you like the program. Or you may even lie to yourself and say you like the program just to watch it with her, to watch it with him. Now that wouldn't be so bad, but the program's on again next week. You know, then what do? And the week after that, and the week after that. And suppose this couple gets married. It's 7:30 Tuesday night. We got to watch this dumb, stupid program again. Yeah. Maybe after 3 years of that, she finally volunteers the information. I never really liked this program too much anyway. I wonder why we watch it. If he doesn't kill her at that point, she's lucky. Huh? Now, where does all that anger come from? It comes from being stored up over the years based on dishonesty. So all of us have a lot of work in those areas to do. In this relationship, where was I selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Let's ask yourself three more questions, too. In this relationship, where did I unjustly arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? Not where did he or she arouse it, but where did I unjustly arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? And you get it all down on paper. And then you go back and you look at that list again and you ask yourself, what should I have done instead? Not that you can change it. Not that in many of those cases that you can make amends without causing more pain or difficulty or harm to other people. But it clarifies your own value system. You see, if I don't know you and you sit down and you want to impress me, you might tell me where you work, who you know, where you went to school. You might even tell me your IQ, your bank balance, what your hobbies are, what your favorite color is, what political party you belong to. You can tell me all those things. Or if I want to get to know you, I may try to find out those kinds of things about you. What your favorite color is. Suppose you tell me all of those things. Now, I know a lot about you. Okay, let's suppose instead of doing that, you tell me the kinds of things that you stay chronically angry about, the kind of things that you are afraid of in your life, and the kinds of mistakes that you make in personal relationships. And if you just tell me those three things, you've now told me more about yourself than that other way or any other way that I know. And this step five that you're preparing for is to say out loud to someone the exact nature of your wrongs. And you know why you're doing that? You're doing it so you get to hear it. You get to hear it yourself and have access into that kind of information. Because if you write it down and you say it out loud in front of someone else and God, it has a new reality and a new meaning, and it impacts you in a very special way. Now, as a result of these three lists, resentments, fears, and sex, you come up with a list of character defects, mistakes that you make in your life, the kinds of areas where you have problems, where you let yourself down, where you needlessly hurt others or yourself. Then you're going to carry that over into step five. So why do you take an inventory? You take an inventory to be free of the pretending that goes on around all of those issues. Because if you want to recover and stay sober, you want to have all of you as comfortable as possible. So let's move on to step five. I'll say a few things about that. Hearing fifth steps on a regular basis can be exhausting. And it's particularly exhausting for those of us who do two things, who like to give advice and who like to analyze. I've learned painfully that the effort of a fifth step is not on my part if I hear your fifth step. I'm not responsible for you doing a good fifth step. And if I talk a lot and if I give a lot of advice and if I ask a lot of questions, I'm doing your work for you. So it's a painful lesson to learn for some of us that like to talk a lot, but the quieter that I am, the better the thing happens. So what I do is, when someone comes to me with a fifth step, I'll promise them confidentiality, thank them for trusting me that way and inviting me into their life in this special way, and I'll walk them through the first three steps. I'll say, are you sure you're an alcoholic? Are you sure you're an overeater? Do you have some kind of a God or a higher power? Have you made a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of that higher power? Oh, and at this point, let me back up to step three. Something that is commonly said about step three is it's hard, it's difficult to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. I don't believe that at all. I used to believe it. I think it's easy. And the reason I think it's easy, step three does not say you turn your will and your life over to the care of a higher power. It says you make a decision to do that. And there's all the difference in the world between making a decision and doing it or acting on it. But those of you who are married, remember? There's a big difference between getting engaged and getting married. Notice the difference? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. It says we make a decision. The other reason why step three is easy, or can be, is if you've done a good job on step one and two. If you really know you got a problem you can't fix, and you know there's some help around, then you're going to team up with the help. That's step three, to make a decision to do that. So, I walk the person through those three steps, and then I say, you've done some inventory, and they show me the work that they've done, written. I said, okay, so now we're ready to begin. The step says we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. Let's consciously include God. And here's a wonderful thing. So let's consciously include him. Let's pray silently that you do the best job you can in the next hour or two or three or however long this takes. And I ask them to pray silently. Now, when people pray silently, why do I ask them, by the way? The reason I ask them to pray silently is simply because I don't want to intimidate anybody by praying out loud because of my spiritual language or my belief, which can be, you know, all someone has to do to me is say, now let us pray to our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. That's kind of a cliche that comes from another kind of spirituality, even though I believe that kind of sets off alarm bells and red lights and everything in my head. I don't want to intimidate anybody to believe in God or trigger any old tapes that might be harmful. I want them to pray to God as they understand Him without me complicating the issue. So that's why I ask them to do it silently. And I pray with them. When most people pray silently, you know what they do? They close their eyes. And everybody I ever asked to do this, and nobody ever knew I was going to do it ahead of time, closes their eyes. And I think the validity of doing it this at this time is proven this way. The problem with two people who are praying silently with their eyes closed is nobody knows when the other one's done. See? So somebody has to peek, you know. And I'm the one that peeks. You know, I kind of open one eye and look. And sure enough, every time I peek, that other person's still gone. That just shows how appropriate this whole thing is. And then, you know, one of us will say amen or something like that. And I say, okay, you've done some work. Just read out loud what you've written and I'll be quiet. And I really am quiet. I never say anything. I don't interrupt at all unless one of two things happens. If I get lost, if somebody's talking about Susie, and I don't know if Susie's this guy's wife or his girlfriend or his secretary or his horse or, you know, if I get lost like that, I'll say, excuse me, who's Susie? On the other hand, too, if the person uses a lot of names, I will say, I'm not particularly interested in hearing first, last names of other people. If it's important for you to include that, that's fine. But if you can just talk about this man or this woman, that's okay with me, because I don't need to know a whole lot about other people. I want to take your inventory, not yours and a lot of other people's at the same time. And by the way, that raises another issue. This is a personal thing with me, but a lot of people agree with it too. When someone asks me to take a fifth step, I tell the person that I would prefer that they not tell anybody who they take their fifth step with. And the reason for that is this. If all of you people here today know that this individual has taken his or her fifth step with me, you all know that I know a lot about her. Why do you need to know that? That doesn't do you any good. It certainly doesn't do this person any good. And the other reason, why I think it is a good idea not to spread that around, is it can be a real ego trip. Like I took my fifth step with so-and-so. Bill Wilson heard my fifth step. Big deal. Or it can be an ego trip the other way around. Somehow, like, if someone took their fifth step with me, I'm somehow responsible for their sobriety. That doesn't have anything to do with what we're about here. So, the only time I interrupt is if I don't understand what's going on, or if I think the person is fudging. And everybody fudges sometime in their inventory, usually. And I had a person who took his inventory with me once, and I asked him when it was all done. I said, I talk to groups about this sometime. Could I share this part of your inventory if I don't use your name? And he gave me permission. He said, sure. Here's what happened. This guy had done a lot of things that you and I would consider rotten. Among other things, he was a wife beater. Now, not all alcoholics are wife beaters, but this guy was. And he didn't want to be. Fall in love with someone, beat him up. Had a lot of wives. Had a lot of girlfriends. You know, they didn't hang around too long. There was one woman that he broke up physically so bad she walks with a walker today. Can you imagine someone who has done something like that having the courage to be able to face up to that and to talk about that? And if you can, you'll know how healing and appropriate it is to talk about that. He talked about those things. But there was one part in his inventory, I thought the poor guy was going to faint. You know, he hung onto the desk, we were sitting across the desk, just hung onto that thing. And all the blood drained out of his face, and his voice rose, and I can't imagine what's coming, but it's going to be big, right? Okay. So he hangs on, and he says, and I stole the rope. You know, big sigh of relief, and he's talking about something else. I do not have clue one what's going on at this point, see. I said, you stole what? He said, I stole the rope. I said, well, what does that mean? He says, I didn't think I was going to have to tell you this, but there was a horse on the other end of the rope. You see, what happened, he stole a racehorse. And it wasn't any little pony, it was a $70,000 horse. And at the point, at the in time when he's taking this inventory, the horse is still not back to the owner. And he wants to do a searching and fearless moral inventory, and he trusts me, but he didn't trust me all that much either. He didn't want to go to jail, thing. So what he does, since he knows it needs to be included in his inventory, he just kind of tosses this little rope in and then tippy-toes onto the next thing and hopes that that counts. Huh? Okay, and he started laughing at this point, just like some of you are doing. And he said, I'm glad you asked me that. You know, if I hadn't told you that, I'd probably got drunk. Happy ending to the story, too. He found a way to get the horse back without it costing any money. And, well, you know, it cost him a couple thousand dollars, I guess, but people didn't find out who stole the horse, and they were happy to get it back, and that was the end of that story. Well, not really, because we cross paths once or twice a year. Every time he sees me, if nobody's listening, he says, thanks for asking about the rope. Now, when you do an inventory, even when you try to be searching and fearless, there's probably a rope in there someplace. There's something you pretty up and call by some other name and hope that that counts. Now, I don't know what's on the other end of your rope, but you do. And whatever it is, call it by its right name. Call it by its right name and be free of it. Those are the only times that I interrupt, when I get lost or when I think the person is being somehow deceptive. If a person has a real hard time getting started, I'll ask this question. I'll say, what's the worst thing you ever did? Now, I caution against asking that question if you're not ready to keep quiet when you hear the answer, because some of the things that you hear are silly. You ask someone what's the worst thing they ever did, maybe one of these wife beaters, and they say something like that, I stole cookies out of my grandmother's cookie jar. And you say, what's that got to do on a scale of 1 to 10 with anything? Well, when he stole the cookies, that was the worst thing he could have ever done, and he's not been able to deal with grandma since then. See, and the emotional power connected with that incident makes it the most important. A lot of times, if you do ask that question to get a person going, once they get that out of the way, they can talk about anything. A lot of times it has to do with early adolescent sexuality problems or issues. And everybody has problems in that area because it's just too big and mysterious to understand or to get right. Someone who gave me permission to talk about it was talking, I think he said he was around 11, and his parents never explained anything about sex. He knew there was a difference between boys and girls, and there was something happening in his body that made the girls appear different all of a sudden. And he heard people talk about it, but indirectly, and he was going nuts because they all knew what they were talking about and he didn't. So one day he was visiting his relatives and his aunt was asleep on the couch. So while she was asleep, he went over and picked up her dress and looked. And that's the worst thing he ever did. And he said, you know, I've never been able to talk to her. I've never been able to look her in the eye since then. You can see what a relief it is to say that kind of a thing out loud and to be free of it. Now, there comes another real awkward time in a fifth step, and that's kind of toward the end, because the person wants to know how well they did. They want to be graded. And you can just see them kind of building up to that, you know. And I die, or I used to, because I don't want to grade anybody's inventory. That's such a big, important, precious thing. I don't want to compare yours to somebody else's. So I beat him to the punch, and I say, how well do you think you did? And usually what people say is, well, I could have done better, but I did as well as I could today. Or occasionally sometimes somebody says, well, I think I left something out. Let me talk about this. Then they grade themselves. Then the awkwardness starts because we don't know when to leave. And the person wants to be complimented and told that they've done a good job and all that. I don't want to interrupt what's going on here, because this is the first time in their life that they've ever faced up to all this pain. And let me tell you something here that I think is important. Those of us involved with fourth and fifth steps are guilty of some false advertising unwittingly. We tell people, take a fourth step, take a fifth step, you'll feel terrific. What the person hears very often that hears us say that is, as soon as I do this, I'm going to feel liberated, and I'm going to hear violins, and there'll be fireworks, and some big cosmic spiritual orgasm, and everything's going to be wonderful. And more often than not, that doesn't happen. The most common, if I can summarize my experience, the most common feeling after a good fifth step that I notice is that people are numb. It's like there's so much going on that their nervous system kind of short circuits. And I think that's appropriate. So however you feel after a fifth step is okay. That's not why you do it. But if you compare your life 3 or 4 months after you've taken a fifth step, then you'll know the difference and you'll know that you feel good. But if you look for that immediate rush or high, you can get into a lot of trouble. Because what a lot of alcoholics will do is say, you know, I've screwed everything else up in my life, now I've blown this too, because I don't feel very good. So we don't like to set people up in that way. This other awkward moment comes is, how do you say goodbye? Well, I beat them to the punch there, and I say, well, you think you've done a good job, and there isn't anything else you'd like to include? Nope, I think we're all right. I said, well, you know where that leaves us? I've asked that question hundreds of times. Every time I've asked it, people say, no. And then I get to say, well, it's called step 6. You've just done step 5. And you have to consciously include someone in your life in step 5. You can't take that by yourself. And I feel privileged and honored to be part of your recovery in this way, and thank you. Go home and read the book where it talks about step 6, 2 or 3 little paragraphs, where it says you take a quiet half hour, hour alone with God and you review what you've done. That's strictly between you and God. So go do that, and I wish you well. And it's clean, and it's quick, and it's appropriate, and that puts a closure on it. Now, step 4 and step 5 are powerful. The first time you do step 4, my suggestion would be that you do it this way, in this classical method. And then as you continue to take inventory, I would also suggest you do it that way. But there's some other things that you can add. Real briefly, let me tell you some that I've found exciting and that people tell me are worthwhile. You might want to make a list of your old ideas. And old ideas are ideas or principles that you've operated on that never worked or don't work anymore. You might find out what those are. Maybe an old idea would be you can't trust men. Or maybe an old idea is all women are weird. Maybe you've operated on those principles all your life. And you found out, hey, that isn't true. I just met an exception the other day. Get rid of the old idea. Another really revealing inventory item would be to inventory your excuses. What are the ways that you have of getting out of things? What do you do to avoid or procrastinate or to put off what it is that you should be doing? That's very revealing also. Another exciting inventory thing would be to inventory the kinds of mistakes that you've made in your life that you like to hang on to or perpetuate or institutionalize or that you're proud of. I know it sounds kind of kooky, but a lot of people are, and it's nice for them to get in touch with it. So it opens up a whole brand new world for you. Step 10 says we continue to take inventory, and my prayer is that you do that also. You take an inventory to be comfortable and to move on. You don't stop at step 5. From there on, you get into action, and you do things with the results of the knowledge that is gained in step 4 and 5. So if you've had the patience to be with me for this hour, I know that you're interested enough to take an inventory or to retake one or to continue. And my prayer is that you be open-minded and searching and fearless and also joyful, because that comes from telling the truth. People who argue with the truth get sick. People who continue to argue with the truth stay sick.